Welcome to Mission Critical, a podcast about the big picture, the purpose, and the values that drive today's most game-changing companies, entrepreneurs, and leaders. I'm your host, Lance Chung, Editor-in-Chief of Glory Media, and I'll be introducing you to a group of brilliant minds who are making an impact on the world and forging the path ahead. While they may all be very different from each other, the question remains the same. What's your mission? This episode is part of a larger series called Momentum, presented by Monogram Appliances, which aims to celebrate Asian leaders. Elevate your culinary domain with Monogram Luxury Appliances, where sophistication meets performance. Each piece is crafted for those who demand excellence. From precision-engineered ovens and cooktops with sapphire glass, to stunning refrigerator interiors that use aerospace technology, you can experience the art of cooking like never before. Monogram is redefining luxury in the kitchen. Visit monogram.ca and transform your kitchen into a statement of elegance and innovation. Young, I'm so happy to be chatting again here in our studio. And, you know, it's not one of our little cafe lunches at the Well this time, but I always love chatting with you, and you've had such an incredible and have such an incredible career and so much perspective. And you've also had, you know, the opportunity to speak to so many entrepreneurs and leaders in government, in the community, and just get really a holistic perspective on what does great leadership look like, what does innovation look like, and what is kind of like the barometer of Canadian success look like. And so I'm really so grateful that you've had time to chat with us, and I'm really excited to talk about it all.
Oh my goodness. I mean, I'm actually very grateful that you asked, because you're putting a bit of a bookend for me. I'm now on my third attempt at retirement. I'm 10 months in, but you caught me first time early in my start at Mars.
Yes.
Which was after my second retirement.
Right.
And so there's my bookend, you know, Lance Chung.
Yeah, it's like a full circle kind of moment.
Full circle and trying to figure out what the heck happened and how did I get through the past 6.5 years.
So, Our next interview is going to be after your fourth retirement.
Oh my God. I'm not allowed to go into a fourth retirement. So I think I'm going to get the most out of this, and then we're just going to keep on going after that.
I love that. I wanted to talk about your, just kind of like the beginning of your career journey. What do you think really inspired you to pursue a career in entrepreneurship, especially within like the technology sector? And how did you kind of distill or kind of focus your efforts towards a career in entrepreneurship, despite kind of, you know, influences in your life saying like, stick to like the straight and narrow?
Yeah, you know what? I mean, like every entrepreneur, my life kind of fits that particular journey of starting with a hypothesis, trying to find my minimum viable product, continuing to pivot as life experience teaches you things that you do or you don't want to do. I mean, you know, my advice growing up from my community and my family was, you know what, Young, you've got such a great bedside manner. You should be like a doctor. And, you know, like, I'm not saying anything different than just probably every other Asian Canadian kid would experience. I'm sure of it. But there's an interesting reaction I had to that, which is that when I said, you know what, I think I'd like to be an entrepreneur as one of the things, everybody kind of poo-pooed me. And then I found out why I really should be an entrepreneur, because that was my juice. When someone told me that, you know what, Young, you're not going to be any good at that. You can't do that. It kind of fired up my juices, and I'm saying, you know what, if someone tells me I can't do something, that's when I double down on it. And even today, like, I'm so easy to manipulate, you know, it's like, Young, I bet you can't get that garbage out by XYZ. Like, I'm on it. But anyway, that was my start of the germ of the idea that I wanted to do something different. I also had a very, I'd say, difficult experience growing up with my family. My father was probably one of the smartest people to ever come out of Taiwan. We came out at the time when Chiang Kai-shek was running you know, a military autocracy in Taiwan, not like Taiwan is today.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was an idealist. He had a photographic memory. There wasn't a book he couldn't just like riff through and memorize the whole thing. My mother, her name, nickname going through school at the National Taiwan University was Madame Curie, because she had this beautiful mind. So you can imagine that growing up in that family, I had, you know, an inferiority complex by the time I was seven,
right,
all the way through. And so when my father and my mother told me that I couldn't do something, I had something to prove. And it wasn't until later in life, much later in life, that I discovered how not how similar I was to my father. Because he was always a contrarian. He was always someone that said, you know, whatever. If everybody's going this way, I'm going to go that way. He was never one to actually accept being part of the flow, being part of the normal. I don't know why he tried to teach his son to do that, but clearly what I saw was different from what I heard. And I think I followed my heart with what I saw, despite objections from my father. Until later in life, I actually discovered how similar we were, and perhaps that led to all the grief for maybe him as well as myself as we were growing up.
Yeah, that's so interesting, and also I think something that a lot of people can relate to, because so many of our kind of formative years are spent maybe resisting a lot of the influences from our family or parents or whatever it might be, and then you realize that we're maybe not so different sometimes, depending on, you know, kind of what lens or discussion we're talking about. But it is something that I think a lot of people can relate to at the end of the day.
No, I mean, when I again try and go through the experience of my parents, I understand it now in such a much more deep way than I perhaps did experiencing just being their son. The things they had to do and the things they had to overcome to escape a military autocracy, to land here with nothing. And to this day, I think that, you know, the immigration experience is one of the most energizing experiences, if you want to look at it that way. Because when you come here, I remember landing in Ville d'Anjou, middle of Montreal, not speaking English, not speaking French, tough neighborhood, North Montreal. And it was a shock, but I don't know who was more shocked. The community around us in Anjou that had never seen anybody Oriental before, or us, who actually, I thought everybody looked the same. It was kind of funny.
Yeah. Because you grew up in a community where you did see yourself represented until you came west, and it was a different kind of conversation here, where the diaspora, we don't feel like we see ourselves, or haven't historically felt like we've seen ourselves represented, because we're not surrounded by our entire community too.
That's right.
That must be such an interesting experience to navigate.
Yeah. You know what? As you're asking that question, it kind of sparks that idea in me too. That just that memory of that as soon as I landed, I understood how different I was. And not different in a unique kind of a way, but different as in, therefore, I was a target.
Yeah, or
right
or
off
the
bat.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so my first reaction, of course, was to become invisible, was to try and blend in, was to try and fit into everything that I saw the community around me was doing, hoping that I would actually eventually belong. So yes, you know, I played in, I think, right to high school. I strove to play in the jazz band, not well, but you know, sufficient to be able to. I tried to play football. I was very good until 12, when everybody who basically, I mean, the same weight and height as I was when I was 12.
Okay.
So the coach said, "You don't know anything about football, but you're going to be a linebacker and just stand in front of people."
Right,
and I said, "Fantastic. Okay." And then those young kids that I used to basically be able to rule on the field, by the time I got to 13, 14 to 16, they turned into giants. So, and they had long memories.
Right.
It was not a great experience. But the point is, I had to quickly convert from trying to fit in, trying to be invisible, trying to blend. And then I decided one day, you know what? I'm never going to. That's impossible. And I think that was the start of the germ of the idea that, you know what? I'm never going to try and fit in. There was an actual incident that happened that where we visited a Chinese restaurant. We won a game. So we all went out to a Chinese, the only Chinese restaurant. It was on the highway going into the small town at the time. There's always one of these, yes, right? Yeah. Chinese Canadian.
Yes, yes. Which is a completely different cuisine.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. And you know it's family run.
Yeah. Exactly.
So of course they came out, they served us, you know, everything, the Chinese Canadian thing. And then my teammates started making fun of the waiter that came in. And they were making jokes. Because at the time, you know, the typical caricature of an Oriental was like Hop Sing, obsequious, buck teeth, a long ponytail or queue, if you want to call it what it is. And so they made, you know, heavy accent. Hop Sing was a character from Bonanza.
Well, and it's also like what they were consuming from, what they were seeing from media and culture.
Completely.
Yeah.
And I guess on one level, it's like they did that in front of me because they didn't see me as different from them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Did I achieve my goal of blending in? Maybe, but not in the way I wanted. Here's what really got me. Because I was still in the mode of sort of like just one of the guys, I started laughing with them, as they were making some pretty cruel jokes about both the people that were working in that restaurant, the family that was there. And when I went home that night and I was brushing my teeth, looking at myself in the mirror, I just did not like what I was seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, that's the first and the last and the only time I will ever try and fit in again, ever. And so that was caused me to then say, you know what, from now on, I'm going to basically create my own pathways. I'm going to do things that inspire others to join me. I'm not going to join anybody else. But if they want to join me, they're only going to join me on my own terms. That was the root of why I became an entrepreneur.
Yeah. And I love that because that is, you know, in stark contrast to the idea of assimilation that you're kind of referencing and talking about, but also parallels a lot of this idea of, you know, being a contrarian in those values that you saw in your father, because entrepreneurship is not about going with the status quo or assimilating. It is really kind of like a contrarian perspective, because you're trying to figure out what is another way of doing something that you can be better or improved upon or innovated. How do you define entrepreneurship for yourself based off of what you've seen in your experiences now?
So I love big problems. And it's not because I'm a sucker for punishment. It's because I don't see problems as problems. I'm actually an optimist. I'm not, you know, a masochist that just basically sees a problem and decides to basically, you know, Don Quixote myself into a stupor.
Yeah.
No, I see problems as actually opportunities. Because if it's a problem that's big, that somebody hasn't solved, what is meeting that challenge and solving for it going to produce by way of impact? And impact always leads to an economic value as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can make purpose and economic value from solving for a problem that you see as a challenge, and of course, you know, this challenge is like someone's telling you, you can't do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course I can. It kind of takes on a bit of a life of its own. And so if you combine the problem-seeking, challenge accepting, transformational nature of an optimistic entrepreneur, And then you say, combine that with a bit of the NFQ quotient, which is the never quit, fill in the F. This is how I think success can be created in a way that drives purpose and impact and brings a community up with you. Mm-hmm. So that became addictive. You know, I think I started maybe 7 companies. The first company was on my 3 credit cards. I was leaving Texas Instruments at the time, I think. Mm. And so I took out my 3 credit cards and I said to myself, Young, if you do not go out and start your first company now, you're never going to do it. Why? Because I was getting a little too comfortable. Mm-hmm. You know, I was making too much money. I was traveling the world. I was starting, you know, businesses for TI. It was fantastic. But I was getting too comfortable. And my inner voice said to me, Young, you're losing your edge. Your edge happens as an immigrant as well when you have nothing to lose and you've got everything to gain. I was starting to feel like if I stayed in this for another year and a half, I would start getting something to lose kind of a mentality. Right. I would lose my edge.
Right.
And so I took out my 3 credit cards, maxed them out, started the first company, hired 1 person, which came 2, became 4, became 8, became 16, eventually about 400. And the other book ended. We sold that company. It became a part of a $1 billion liquidity event to the biggest software company in the world. That's my first company. And then there was, you know, 6 more companies after that, 2 of which failed, 3 of which returned capital, and 2 great liquidity events. If you track the entrepreneurial space at all, you'll know that's actually a pretty good track record.
Yeah, definitely. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. I survived. Actually, at one time, I was probably almost as good looking as you. And I think you're a little bit taller than me. So this is what happens when you go through the journey.
When I met you, you were pretty much fresh on your journey as being the new CEO of Mars Discovery District. Yeah. That does not seem that long ago, but it's been a minute since we had that first photo shoot.
Yeah.
Goodness. And so when you... How long were you CEO at Mars for?
Oh, there's another story behind that one. I was a CEO for exactly 6 years and 2 months. So I was into my 7th year.
Okay. So when you took that position, what excited you about the opportunity? I mean, you already had a lot of success behind you already. You could have retired then. And so what excited you about the opportunity, and what was kind of your mandate personally, but also professionally, going into that role and leading an organization like that?
I realized how fortunate I was in all of those experiences. That first company I told you about, it was an interesting story, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
About the 3 credit cards on one end and, you know, the $1 billion liquidity event on the other. That's not really the story. The story was surviving the tech bust. The story was surviving Tyco, Enron, AIG, Sarbanes-Oxley. The story was, after reaching that liquidity event, being in Beijing at a Raffles hotel, the only hotel which would allow it to be seen, CNN at the time, and watching the great financial crisis, the great financial recession, essentially Lehman Brothers imploding, and then the whole financial services sector imploding 3 weeks after we reached our liquidity event, like just by the skin of our teeth.
Wow.
We should have failed so many times over, Lance, in that first journey. So I knew how fortunate I was, to come back to your question. I knew how fortunate I was in terms of my entrepreneurial career. And by then, I had really started to understand and appreciate all the sacrifices that my parents had made on our behalf of their family to come out here. And I remember when my mom and dad were still alive, I remember talking to them and I said, you know what? We all agreed we've been so fortunate. And we had a little bit of a pact, which was, if we ever, any one of us, were to find ourselves in a position of some privilege, because we came from nothing, Lance. We came here, my father, my mother, they came here, they had to restart. They had nothing. Thank God they had their brains and their capabilities. Mm-hmm. They said, if we ever find ourselves in a position of privilege, we should find a way to give something back to a country where we don't just owe our livelihoods to this place, we actually owe our lives to this place. Literally. Mm-hmm. So that was it. Mars was my project to kind of say, for all the good fortune I've had from landing in a place like Canada. And by the way, I don't think this is a perfect country. I think we are an imperfect country with great aspirations and great sort of potential. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a perfect country in the world, actually. So Mars was my give back project. And the story about when I started was when I was negotiating with the chair of the board, Gord Nixon, who was the former CEO mm-hmm. and chair of RBC, and Richard Ivey at the time. I said, I only have one condition. I'm not going to negotiate anything except for one thing, mm-hmm. which is I want to give you my notice today.
I remember the story. I love the story. Yeah.
So, yes. We met only a few months after that, which is when I first told you that story. So it's actually true. November 2017, I said, you know, Richard, Gord, I think I'm going to stay for 5 years. And to me, it was like a donation of 5 years of my life, probably the most productive years of my life. Mm-hmm. So Richard and Gord, I think, came back and said, well, Young, we're looking more for a new CEO for, you know, 10 years. Can you give us at least 7? And I thought about it and I said, well, how about we cut that in middle and let's go with 6. And so sure enough, at 6 years and 2 months, December 31st, 2023, I finished out. But I set that date right at the beginning of the whole journey. And the reason, Lance, is because I'm in the innovation game. I'm in the business of building companies and helping organizations and other founders to build companies. You can't really have innovation without a real commitment to renewal, especially in that top seat. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, the Mars journey over the past, 6 years and change, that journey was not what I pictured it would be when I started either, right? Because somewhere in the middle, there was like a once-in-a-100-year pandemic, which lasted about 3 years before they actually, declared it done. There was all kinds of, changes of government. But that community at Mars grew 450% during the time I was there.
Wow.
It went from 6,000 people with 1,200 companies to 32,500 people by the time I left, driving about $30 billion of GDP during that time. So, again, I'm not saying that it's all due to me. In fact, I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying, number one, at least I didn't drop the ball. But number two, there's a special sauce to the entrepreneurial mindset. And if we can not only help our entrepreneurs succeed, we can also then partner with them to do what? To solve some of the biggest and most intractable problems that, again, problems are opportunities. Mm-hmm. Some of the biggest challenges that turn into opportunities for Canada on a global stage can be done by partnering with our entrepreneurs. And this, I believe, has to be the future of this nation.
Yeah. Over the course, I'm also realizing through our chat right now too, is that over the course of your tenure there at Mars, not only did you lead the organization during a pandemic, but it also overlapped through very large moments of culture where we were having larger discussions around diversity. There was the Black Lives Matter movement too, and that conversation was opened up a lot more during the course of your tenure, and that obviously has is in tandem with the whole kind of hypothesis and kind of principle of entrepreneurship being able to solve problems. But when you also have diverse perspectives on entrepreneurship, you can solve even more problems or have more approaches to problems that you wouldn't, you know, have otherwise, or people wouldn't have otherwise considered, because they were looking through the lens of, or one lens, I guess. So how was that? How did your perspective and your experience kind of being there to help open doors while you were the CEO at Mars, how did those kind of two things go in tandem with each other?
Yeah, thank you for the question, actually. And thank you for all the questions, to be honest. You asked me some of these questions 5 or 6 years ago, and you're so thought-provoking, actually. But
we should go back to the original interview and see
how
things have changed.
That would be an interesting A-B test, actually. But yes, absolutely. I, as a result of my experiences growing up, being an immigrant, being a visible minority, in a community which had nobody else that looked like me, I developed a perspective of from that lived experience, which I think maybe explains a lot. But when George Floyd was murdered in May of 2020, it struck a dagger into not just my heart, but I think everybody that saw this and was horrified by this. And so in June of 2020, I and my co-founder of an organization that I call CELAR, is Armughan Ahmad, and he was interviewing me for a KPMG digital show at the time. And we looked at each other and said, we have to just do something about this. And so we started the Coalition of Innovation Leaders Against Racism in that moment, in June. And the whole idea was, we have to find a way in order to eliminate every single component of systemic bias that exists in organizations and institutions which prevent those people that don't fit the traditional sort of look and feel to actually give them pathways. And in particular in the innovation economy. Why? Because it's a blank canvas. This is where, you know, the growth of Canada is coming from. This is where the new ideas, the new solutions, the new challenges are coming from. How do we actually inspire pathways for participation and leadership for Black people, Indigenous peoples, from our, you know, persons of color? And in fact, beyond that, how do we actually create these pathways into participation and leadership and innovation for other segments? So it's an inclusive lens as opposed to just a pure diversity lens. You know what I mean? By that difference?
Yeah.
It says, you know, my co-founder, Armughan Ahmad, is Muslim. I'm Chinese, I guess Buddhist would be my upbringing. The chair of CELAR is Claudette McGowan, one of the most amazing entrepreneurs and business leaders we have in Canada. She's Jamaican-Canadian. It's about allyship. And it's about sort of how do we actually create these pathways into this wonderful growing piece of Canada that can actually include and invite others from under-recognized communities to participate. I'll tell you why that's so important, because talent is actually the fuel for the entire innovation community. Think about where our youngest and highest growth Canadians are coming from. It's actually our Indigenous community.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
And they're rights holders, not just stakeholders in Canada. One of my biggest passions going through Mars was, like, this is a problem or a challenge or an opportunity, was climate.
Climate.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, Canada is 0.5% of the population of the world, and we're producing over 2% of the actual emissions and I think every year we blow out 750 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions. The globe is 50 billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions. But Canada has 14% of the top innovators in clean tech in the world every single year when you go to San Francisco and they get chosen. So partnering with indigenous communities that own the resources, they have the rights. In order to solve for renewable sources of energy, clean water, in order to solve for how you actually can utilize the land that we borrow from our children, not that we inherit from previous generations, but that we borrow from future generations. The lessons that they can share with us, the fact that they are the fastest growing and youngest population segment in Canada, we're shooting ourselves in our own foot if we're not unlocking the value of the talent that can come from that community. How about our immigration communities? You know, Canada right now has gone a free fall down the productivity chart. I mean, by 2030, we are projected by the OECD to be number 38 in all the advanced countries that are looking at
38. Wow.
You know how many countries are tracked by the OECD?
Right.
38.
God, that's awful.
Exactly. Dead last is absolutely dead
last. Oh, Lord.
How can we inoculate that free fall?
Yeah.
Well, if you believe what I just said about the innovation economy, the source of great talent, unlocking the value of our youth so that they can actually drive solutions in artificial intelligence, they can drive solutions to climate change. By the way, those are two super cycles that are going on. They can find new solutions that, although we're living longer, we're living not as well. You know, we're sick for longer. So using technology to solve for big, big, big problems and challenges by backing our youth to actually become entrepreneurs and new leaders, that's our pathway to freedom, and that's our pathway to happiness. If we don't do that, Canada's just wasted its biggest resource.
Yeah, harnessing what we already have.
Right.
Yeah.
We should be able to go from number 38 last to, I believe, near right back to where we were in the top five.
Yeah.
Just by doing that. And if we don't, then we deserve what we get.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of perspective there.
But coming back to CELAR and coming back to, you know, the inclusion aspect, this is why I think it's so important for our biggest organizations, our biggest institutions, our entrepreneurs to really think about how do we solve for Canada's biggest problems, let's say productivity and future prosperity. How do we solve for these things by including people that have never been asked to be included before? And by the way, we have a blank canvas to paint upon. So we're not trying to battle inertia. And CELAR itself is composed of the top innovation companies around Canada, you know, from Google to Salesforce to Meta in Canada to JP Morgan to OMERS through to Toronto Public Library through to Toronto Metropolitan University, University of Waterloo. I can go on, but the point is these are all leaders within these organizations that are committed to creating pathways for, you know.
Yeah. People I think it's change and want the momentum.
They do.
Yeah.
They do. This is our way to address, you know, I think, you know, both the inequity, but also the opportunity for Canada, which is unique.
CELAR was, as you mentioned, created at a big kind of turning point in culture, history, and our community. How have you, you know, over the course of the year since its inception, how the goalposts change? How have, you know, what's different now versus then? And what kind of progress has been made? How do you feel like impact has been realized?
That's a very good question. CELAR was created in June of 2020. And I think we got really good things done between 2020 to 2024. that organization too had to find ways to help our young people through the, you know, 2020 to 2022 and a half of the pandemic,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, very fragile. It was just a very, very challenging period for our communities and for the people within our communities, and it particularly hit the underrepresented communities much, much harder.
Disproportionately, yeah.
Absolutely. It's resulted in a whole sort of challenges to mental health and all the rest of it, but I think CLR did really good work during those early days. And I think 2024 to 2030, it is, now that that work has been done, so finding ways to extract the best practices that eliminate bias within organizations from places like HP, places like JP Morgan, places like Toronto Dominion Bank, now finding ways to, how do we create scale in this now? So 2024 to 2030 for us is about building, you know, a new platform that says it's not just best practices from every one of the CLR members that we're going to basically now be able to offer to the community. Mm-hmm. Let's build a inclusive innovation as a service platform. And this is to connect the community that we are all here to help, to create that grassroots capability. And so I think the next 6 years are back to how I've always thought about the innovation community. Can we start to harness and partner with the folks that we've been helping all the way along to actually solve for some pretty big problems? Can we create an inclusive innovation as a service platform that connects these best practices and basically starts to deploy them out beyond just the members of CLR into the community that they serve and into the communities that work for these organizations?
Yeah.
That's how we create a grassroots movement out of this whole thing, as opposed to just benefiting those that are part of the club. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So what do you tell entrepreneurs, or what's the best advice that you have for business owners, entrepreneurs, especially ones that are from underrepresented communities, whether that's BIPOC communities, women, queer, underrepresented communities that feel like they're facing a bit of an uphill battle, especially when you see some of these reports and stats come out about the amount of, say, for example, VC dollars that are going to women-owned companies or BIPOC companies? What's the best advice, if you can distill it into one piece of advice, that you can have for these individuals and entrepreneurs?
There's so many pieces of advice I wish I could give, actually. One of which is that don't be afraid of challenge. Mm. Challenge is what creates opportunities. So don't, if you can stand the pain, you're going to get to the gain. So, you know, let's put that as number one. But number two is find your allies. They do exist. So part of it is about sort of going, meeting challenge with a equal amount of energy to find your way around, over, through, under, whatever it takes. And the allies are going to come not just from your own community, actually. There are people that, and I've seen this in CLR, it's not just Asians helping Asians, Black people helping Black people, people of color helping people of color, Indigenous community. You know what I mean? It's not that, actually.
Mm-hmm.
The allyships come from those that say, you know what, let's have an inclusive view of the world. Let's embrace each other's differences. I mean, there is a bit of a danger that says, you know what, if we're only basically saying Asians for Asians, Black people for Black people, we're just actually creating our own silos.
Yeah.
How do we break our silos down, find the ways of intersectional opportunities that we see people as people and embrace each other's differences? And that to me is where 1 + 1 = 11, not 2. Mm. In fact, 1 plus 1 traditionally has equaled 1.5, if you're lucky. How do we get to 11? Mm-hmm. By embracing each other's differences and by seeing that the sum of the parts is actually greater than the individual pieces.
Yeah. It's that whole mindset of like, absolutely, high tides lift all boats. It's not absolutely just one boat or two boats.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's beautiful people out there and they all want to help. And, you know, my own story is that we did not come from privilege. And we absolutely are in a moment where we can say we've arrived. We've been lucky. We've been fortunate. That's okay. But I think there's a responsibility that comes with privilege. And that responsibility is, how do you pay it forward? How do you give back? How do you, and I think by making a few deposits, you always get more withdrawals along the way, actually. You make more withdrawals, you actually don't get as many back. So paying it back and helping and finding a way to pay it forward, that's the responsibility of privilege. And so there's people that want to help. And for people that feel like they're stopped, find your tribes. They may not look like you. They may not just be from your community, but they're there to help you gain the success because they have the same lived experience as what you're going through right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes total sense, yeah. Okay. Last question. What excites you the most about the road ahead? What energizes, what gives you energy, what gives you hope, and joy and optimism? Even though you're already an optimist.
Yeah, I am an optimist, yeah. I think cycles, what comes up eventually comes down. What comes down eventually comes up. Cycles are just a force of nature. Mm-hmm. I think we've hit bottom of this particular cycle, and you know, don't let the door hit it on its way out, because I'm happy to see it done. But I think we're actually on a bit of an up cycle. One has to be optimistic about life, you know, because you can sit here and say, one can sit here and say, oh my God, you know, are we going to have a planet or not? Oh my God, is, you know, AI going to result in killer robots coming to exterminate humankind? Or one can say, there are solutions to climate. There are solutions that can be driven through artificial intelligence. There are ways to unlock pathways for young people into the future. So I'm an optimist, but I also see Canada as being a potential inspirational, multi-generational destination for talent and the ingenuity, which will attract the capital, which will attract the opportunity for us to collectively make a multi-generational sort of deposit stream of impact. Mm-hmm. So when you tell me there's a bunch of problems, I say, you know what, fantastic. These are all challenges.
Opportunities.
Right. Now, yeah. How do we leverage, you know, I know I got more years behind me than ahead of me, Lance. I know that. But I know the things that I have unfinished business. The things that I have unfinished business about, I think, are about starting and doing things that I will hand over to others that will have to continue. And so I'm an optimist because I'm an optimist about Canadians and I'm an optimist about our youth. We have to help produce pathways, and the work continues. Challenges are not just problems. Challenges are also opportunities. And if we go down, we got to go down fighting. But I'm going to bet that we're gonna basically solve some of these things, which will change the things we see as the traps today. I mean, I'm an optimist.
I love that. I feel so energized talking to you. It's like you're like caffeine for my brain, and it just wakes me up. It's been really, really great chatting with you as always, and I just I love seeing your perspective on everything and also the work that you're doing through CLAR and just the mentorship, formal or informal, that you have with you know, people that are in the community. So, and thank you for coming in and having this chat.
It's an honor. I've seen how you've developed Glory through the years as well. And I mean, you have such a true North Star, Lance, and so does your media operation. And it's inspiring, actually. You should see the faces on my colleagues from CELAR when we visit your events. Mm-hmm. They come out of there, as you say, like, you know, they just hit the caffeine in the brain kind of a thing, and it's like inspiring. So, you know, the work carries on. You're going to be here long after I'm no longer here. And we need to basically enable, you know, purposeful leaders to carry on the work that absolutely has to be that absolutely has to kind of happen, so that we can carry on the future, the success, the opportunities that come with this fortunate place that we happen to find ourselves in.
That's a great note to end on, and thank you again so much for the chat.
It's my pleasure.
If you enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you left a review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know what you liked, who you'd like to see on the show, and anything else you want to share. To keep up to date, subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen to your podcasts. Until next time, ask yourself, what's your mission?